Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, January 12th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we begin today in Southern California, where a lot of people don't have the time or the luxury to be outraged by the president's latest comments. In the early hours of Tuesday morning in small and affluent Montecito near Santa Barbara, California, neighbors woke up to a sound like a freight train and a horrifying scene, mud rushing down the mountain into their community and down the streets. Mud as much as 10 feet deep in some places, tossing boulders and cars, even uprooting houses. At least 17 people are dead, and rescue workers are searching for dozens more still missing. Here's Santa Barbara County Sheriff Bill Brown on CBS on Wednesday.
I think most people are really shocked at the extent of the damage and how big the impact was to the area. Although we knew that this was coming, it was just, you couldn't help but be amazed at the intensity of the storm and the result of the mudslide and the water that cascaded down the hills as a result of that.
Only a few weeks ago, Montecito and the surrounding area went through another harrowing natural disaster, a massive wildfire that burned more than 250,000 acres. The fires created a landscape ripe for floods and mudslide, denuded of trees, and the mud came down much more quickly than many residents expected. Montecito resident Ben Hyatt talked to us about the harrowing moment when the mud came.
I actually saw the rain coming, and I kind of thought that it might be a bad storm. So I actually did try to stay awake. I actually fell asleep on the couch in the living room, and I was awoken when the power went out or flickered, and then our fans started going. I immediately tried to figure out what was going on, went out the front door and looked, and it was just raining. And then it started raining really, really hard, like the hardest I've seen.
What happened next?
So from there, I looked out on the street and there was, you know, water going down the street, like maybe 1 or 2 inches, nothing out of the ordinary. Went back inside. That cell storm that was really powerful was 5 minutes. And so when the cell storm went over our house, it was headed straight for the mountains. So that started to worry me a little bit. I knew it was short, but I also knew that's where the fires were. So I went inside and thought, well, I better stay up just in case, and made a snack and got 2 bites into my snack. And all of a sudden there was just this loud whoosh and the house shaking. And other people have described it as a locomotive. And I think that's how I would describe it now as well. And it was at that point, 3 feet of mud surrounding the house, and it was pitch black.
You looked out the window of your house and could you see the mud piling up?
Yeah, that was the scary part. So the back part of our house is a lot of glass, windows and stuff. And so our glass garden doors all started buckling inwards. The mud was trying to push in. And at that point, it was about 3 feet. That surprised me because I thought our backyard was pretty sheltered from the mountains. And so I immediately, my son was sleeping in his room. My daughter, thankfully, was at a sleepover away from our house. So my 8-year-old, I went in and grabbed him and threw him on, the top bunk. What I was most concerned about, even though we're 2 miles from the base of the mountain, I was most concerned that mud was just going to keep rising. I really, at that moment, thought that it could end up going as high as the ceiling. My wife woke up to my screaming to get up, and the first instinct was to push furniture against all the glass and the doors to keep them from shattering and everything coming in. And there was definite panic at that point. Mm.
And how did you and the family get out of the house?
I thought, well, we can't open the doors. If we open the doors, all the mud's coming in. I was trying to figure out how we could get to the roof and couldn't figure that out. So there wasn't a lot you could do at that particular moment. But then the mud ended up receding about 6 inches over the next 3 hours, still, you know, mid-thigh deep. And firemen then started coming around the neighborhood around 7 a.m. to get everybody out of the neighborhood.
And what happened with you and what happened with the neighbors waiting for rescuers to show up and when they finally did?
Well, there's a couple stories on our street. So I could hear right after this hit, I thought it was a cat, but it was a lady across the street. yelling for help, which I wanted to help her, but I couldn't get across that river of mud. And thankfully, I watched from her kitchen. Our neighbor that lives next door to her was able to go in and get her out. But her wall had collapsed. Her mountain-facing wall had collapsed in the bedroom she was sleeping in, and she got thrown against a wall. We have another lady, the group of houses that are at the top of the neighborhood that parallel the mountains. The mud came right through her house and her son's bedroom. They ended up using a mattress to get up onto the roof. Just scary stuff.
And home is unlivable now. I know, Ben. Where are you right now, by the way, talking to us?
So we're in a hotel up in Pismo Beach. We kind of evacuated with a couple other Montecito families. And we just wanted to get our kids' minds off this. And so we're up at a beach hotel about an hour and a half up the coast.
But this is the second time in the last few weeks even that you've been evacuated, right? I mean, as trying a time as this is, you've kind of had a 1-2 punch because the fires were through your area not too long ago.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We were just through this in December. So, you know, we put up our Christmas tree and celebrated my daughter's birthday. And then the next day, we were actually the first day of the fires, we were a voluntary evac zone. But the air quality was terrible and writing was on the wall that it wasn't going to be good. So we left, and later that afternoon, it became a mandatory. So we spent 9 days in a hotel in Santa Monica for the fires.
And then back home and now this.
Back home, and we actually went to Canada for Christmas, came home, kids had 2 days of school, and then this happened.
It's an awful time, Ben, and I'm glad that you and your family are okay, but Montecito is a small town, 17 people as far as we know now already dead and dozens more missing, which is tragic in and of itself, but it's a small place. I mean, this is a lot of people.
Yeah, Montecito is very small and it's very, very tight-knit. That's why we love it. And, you know, we know so many of our neighbors and so many of the people in our school. We did get good news that all 400 families in our school are accounted for and safe, which is incredible. But there's a couple of the names that have passed away that we know. And it's very sad. And we're just not hearing any good news. Hopefully we'll hear better news today. Mm.
And how are the kids? What are you able to tell them at this point?
The kids are actually with me now, but my son Jack, I will tell you, was very, very brave throughout it all. He was carried out on the back of a fireman, which is always fun for an 8-year-old boy. My daughter Riley, thankfully, she was on the other side of the 101, so just, you know, 6 blocks away at a sleepover. She missed the whole thing, and she was so happy to see us in the morning, and the neighborhood she was in, which again was 6 blocks away, it was like nothing happened.
And what are you hearing from school at this point? It's a tight-knit community, a one-school school district, but so many families affected, and the school affected as well. What are you hearing from them?
The last I heard, I think the school at the moment is not open, but they're hoping to be open on Monday. But I don't know how that's going to happen.
Was school closed in December when the fire warnings and the evacuations came?
Yes. So what they did is they closed school, you know, for a couple of days. And then they decided, you know what, it's Christmas vacation or holiday vacation. Maybe let's just cancel the week. So the kids lost a week there. They've lost, I guess, this week. And my wife actually just mentioned that nobody can get in. I mean, that whole area, I just don't know how they're going to do school.
And when do you think you might head back?
I don't know. I don't think we're going to be in our house for a few weeks. Hopefully at some point we can actually get into the house and get some stuff out. But I think that maybe we can get back to Montecito, hopefully, or maybe just Santa Barbara in the next week or so.
Well, Ben, you taking the time at a time like this to talk to us and share your experience with us, it means an awful lot. So I wish you the best, and the kids and your wife, your whole family up there in Pismo. So thanks again.
Thank you. I appreciate your time as well.
Ben Hyatt is from Montecito, California. His home is currently evacuated. And you can see how Ben documented the damage to his home and his neighborhood on his Twitter feed. It's Caffeine Ben. Give you a real sense of the severity and the devastation of these mudslides in California.
My
Montecito Union School is in a public safety exclusion zone right now, so we can't even step foot on campus because the hardworking first responders are still in an active recovery mission.
That's Anthony Rainey. He's superintendent for the Montecito Union School District, where Ben Hyatt's kids go to school. He says the school is physically okay, but there's no gas, no safe drinking water.
Some of the roads are still impassable, including 101, a main artery throughout California, of course, but also it's a big way that our staff members get to the site.
But even once the school opens its doors, eventually, Superintendent Rainey says it's not just a matter of getting back to classes.
We expect that some folks will be, you know, out of their homes and relocated for a period of time while, you know, we've got homes destroyed, we've got homes filled with mud, we've got people that are missing vehicles and possessions, you know, some people literally left with the clothes on their back and all of their other possessions are gone. So, you know, we're planning a compassion center at Montecito Union School to, you know, give families information, connect them with services, and, you know, welcome families back as they're able to return to school.
Anthony Rainey says the school is also preparing the extra help the kids might need when they do come back.
We know for some, they'll want to go right back into math and art and go on to other things. Other students will need to process with their teachers, and other students will need to have some more significant resources. So we are bringing some mental health professionals onto campus to make sure we can attend to that. And you can't always predict which students will need support. So we're trying to get multi-layers of support ready to take the kids where they are.
Anthony Rainey is the superintendent of the Montecito Union School District. And again, our thanks to Ben Hyatt for sharing his family story with us. Are you or your loved ones affected by the mudslides in Southern California? Call us, tell us your stories. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. Let's talk now about kids and reading, because let's face it, it's not always easy to get kids to read.
Why would a child turn a page? A child isn't polite. I mean, adults will conscientiously read a book they dislike because they feel they should. Children don't feel any such compulsion. If they hate the first two pages, swammo against the wall, that's the end of the book. They don't care if it's won 18 Caldecott Awards, right? Okay, so you've got to catch them. You've got to catch them in a kind of rhythmic pattern, in a kind of syncopation that makes them turn that page.
Well, that's a pretty reliable source on children's literature there. Where the Wild Things Are, author Marie Sendak speaking back in 1985. Well, in 2008, the Library of Congress created a new position to encourage kids all across the country to turn that page. It's the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. And on Tuesday, author Jacqueline Woodson began her two-year term in that position. Jacqueline Woodson is, of course, the author of young adult hits like Miracles Boys and Brown Girl Dreaming. She's here now to talk about what she hopes to accomplish during her tenure as National Ambassador. Jacqueline Woodson, what a pleasure. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You've written a lot of books, as I mentioned, for young readers. Do you agree with Marie Sendak there? Now, his readers are younger maybe than a lot of yours, so maybe a different way to get them to turn the page. But what do you think about what he had to say?
Well, I actually write picture books all the way up to adult fiction.
So all the way through.
Yeah, all the way through. And I think what Maurice is saying is as true today as it was when he said it, as true as it was from the beginning of the time of books. So you have to get in there and catch the reader and hold them and give them books that are well-written and well-illustrated to keep them turning those pages.
What's the job like National Ambassador? Obviously radio shows like this one where hopefully people go and read books and give books to their kids. A lot of libraries, I imagine. What else?
A lot of going into the places where the young people are and engaging them. So yesterday I was at Revolutionary Books up in Harlem speaking to young people from middle schools. I'm going into juvenile detention centers. I'm going into homeless shelters. I plan to go into a lot of classrooms or Skype in with classrooms. So anywhere where I can meet the children where they are.
Now, the platform that you chose for your time as ambassador is Reading Equals Hope Times Change. What does that mean?
It means that when you open up a book, you come to it with a sense of hope for what you're going to get out of it. Or as Sendak says, you know, you hope you want to turn that page. There is this desire to have good literature. And when you read a book that you love, it changes you. You're someone different from when you first started reading that book to when the book is over.
You know, hope and change, when I read this tagline, reading equals hope times change, I took sort of a political message out of it. And that's me as the reader. It seemed to tap into a sense in these political times that everybody's thinking about what's going on in the country and in the streets, even kids. Well, now, that's how I interpreted it. Is that right?
It is true. I mean, and then, of course, it's a play on words, too, right? Yeah. Hope times change. But we have to understand that young people don't live in a bubble. They're very much aware of this moment in time that we're living in. And they're very much aware of both their powerlessness as young people and their empowered selves, and that they are carrying this mantle forward. So I think one thing that reading can do, that good books can do, is show them ways in which they can engage in the world, ways in which they can meet other people first on the page and then in the real world.
Well, I wanted to take the chance while you're here, Jacqueline Woodson, to get some of your best recommendations for children's literature, both young adult and kids, while the parents are listening, the aunts and uncles in my case. What are the best books out there right now?
I think, I can't speak to the best books out there. I think there's so many amazing books out there, and it depends on the reader, what they're going to consider the best for who they are or what they need in the moment. But I think there's some people doing some amazing stuff. One book that I really love these days is Crown, An Ode to the Fresh Cut by Derek Barnes, which is a picture book about a haircut, but it's about so much more. And I think that's one thing that happens with literature. You know, young adult and children's writers have historically been somewhat subversive, and a lot of the books are telling many stories. And there's The Bells by Danielle Clayton, The Stars Beneath Our Feet by David Barclay Moore, and then, of course, Joe Bruschak, who is a First Nation writer who's been writing forever, writes picture books, writes middle grade. There's a great book called The People Shall Continue by Simon J. Ortiz. Margarita Ingle is the Young People's Poet Laureate right now, and she's also a writer of picture books that are beautiful and also middle grade.
She's been on the show.
I love her so Wonderful. Much. Cynthia Leidick Smith is another Native writer. Meg Medina, Kwame Alexander, of course, who wrote The Crossover and Solo. He was the Newbery Award winner. Jason Reynolds is blowing up and writing so many amazing middle grade books for everybody, but particularly speaking to young men of color. And I have two more. Rita Williams Garcia, Elizabeth Acevedo, her book The Poet X is an amazing book. One more. Vashti Harrison, Little Leaders is a fabulous picture book.
Well, it's a great reading list. It covers the full range, and that's for parents, for moms and dads, aunts and uncles, cousins, anybody who's buying books for young people now or wants to point them toward the library. Before we let you go, Jacqueline, just say a word if you would. Something I'm curious to hear you talk about. It's a world of distractions, isn't it? And content, unlimited choices, information for kids. What's the best pitch for the book?
What's the best pitch?
The best pitch to a 12-year-old for the book right now.
You can leave this moment for a while. You know, when you open a book, you can go somewhere else for a while, and that's a great thing. And again, it comes down to the 12-year-old. Whoever I'm speaking to, I'm going to have a different message for them. But think about the glory of being able to leave the world.
Jacqueline Woodson, author, National Ambassador for Young People's Literature for the Library of Congress. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yes, I love technology, but not as much as you see. But I still love technology, always and forever.
Let's get some news from Vegas now, because the International Consumer Electronics Show, better known as CES, concludes today in Las Vegas. It's been going on all week, and like every year, It's a chance for the tech companies to showcase their latest gadgets.
It's a concept laptop that uses the Razer phone as a brain slash trackpad.
Thumbnail-sized chip embedded into objects around the house, like chairs.
Listen to your calls with the tip of your finger.
This is a 146-inch TV.
Cars that can read your emotions, your brain waves, even a flying car.
Flying cars. This time, for real, your car reading your emotions? Well, maybe not. It's probably one of the many products at the Consumer Electronics Show that won't quite live up to the hype. Taylor Lorenz is a tech reporter for The Daily Beast. She just got back from Vegas. Hi, Taylor.
Hi.
Well, look, there's plenty of time to focus on all the cool gadgets, the next level technology, the smart home thermostat that will change everything. I know those things are coming. Let's spend a little time and talk about the worst of the CES. Why not? What was the worst of the stuff that you saw?
For me, the most disappointing was the Foldimate, which is this giant machine that you can buy for $850 that's supposed to fold your clothes.
Oh, I heard about this.
So I am probably the laziest person ever. We all hate folding our clothes. And so I was kind of excited about the concept for this machine. And I kind of imagined a machine where you could just dump your laundry in and it'd come out folded, like the Jetsons. This machine was anything but. First of all, it's bigger than a washing machine. It takes up, and I have no idea how you would fit it in a New York City apartment. And you have to basically individually clip and feed each item through the machine, which is almost more time consuming than just folding it at that point. And then it doesn't even fold sweatshirts, baby clothes, a lot of the stuff that you'd kind of want it to. So it's just one of those things where it's like almost $1,000, doesn't exactly do what you want. The concept is there, the execution is not. And that sort of seemed to be the theme of most of the products. Also, a lot of robots, a lot of random sort of like companionship robots.
And let's talk about robots. Let's talk about drones. Drones are really hot right now. Is there anything?
You mentioned, I think they said a flying car. There was actually a drone that was supposed to be the first sort of human carrying drone that could barely get off the ground. They blamed it on the rain. There was the first rain in Vegas for 120 days, but it sort of just hopped a little bit and then remained on the ground.
But Taylor, what's the overall aim here? It seems like the consumer tech market is flush with so much cash that the idea here is just do anything, throw it at the wall and see if it sticks.
Yeah. I mean, all these companies like Samsung, LG, you know, they'd spend hundreds of thousands of dollars constructing these booths, launching these products. And I think you're right to say that it's sort of see what sticks. I think that the concepts obviously come first before the sort of technological executions. And it's interesting to see what people are thinking about. I do feel like a lot of it is sort of just like built on selling hype to consumers and not necessarily, I guess, delivering them the solutions that they were promised.
Well, look, let's not be too negative. Let's give a shot to one great gadget. Let's end on an up note here.
That's a really good question. I actually have to say I was partial to this tiny drone called the Air Selfie. Look, like I honestly, it sounded so stupid, but I still think about it. It's a drone the size of the credit card and it'll take selfies for you. It's probably the most useless product. Oh, you know what was really neat? There was this small sort of pillow that was sort of called a mini robot, but it was this pillow that would mimic breathing and it was supposed to be for you to hug while you went to sleep. And it was so relaxing and peaceful. Everyone sort of loved it. And I don't know. I thought it was nice.
Well, imagine all the energy you would have saved from not having to extend your arm for that selfie, thanks to the flying selfie drone. Taylor Lorenz, a tech reporter for The Daily Beast. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You Liam Neeson's?
Yep, I am.
I told you I would find you. I hope I'm on another boat when your luck runs out.
You feel you've gotten a good night's entertainment, then go ahead, tip the dancing bear.
I'm funny, right?
And I don't even try.
This is just how I talk now, which is pretty cool, yeah?
Release the Kraken.
Penicillin works just as well.
Inspector, leave.
The one and only
Liam Neeson.
I'm down and active talking about Liam Neeson's.
It's full Liam here on Movie Fridays. They're gone all Liam all the time back there in the control room. I love it. Rafer, what do you think?
I love it. Where's it? Was Good Cop, Bad Cop in there from Lego Movie? I didn't hear him.
I don't know if I heard Krull. I hope I did. Did I hear Krull, somebody?
Oh,
I'm not getting a thumbs up about Krull. Nobody has seen that movie. They should not see it. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday here with us. Good to have you, Rafer.
You too, John.
We've got the new Liam Neeson movie, The Commuter, coming up. I've got some Liam Neeson trivia for you. Don't answer now, Rafe. You're going to answer this back at the end. I want you to listen to this classic, this ever so classic Liam Neeson line.
What I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. If you let my daughter go now, that'll be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you.
Your task is to complete that famous, classic Liam Neeson line. Rafer, hold on to that.
All right.
Let's go to the commuter. Liam Neeson, Vera Farmiga, Patrick Wilson. A businessman is caught up in a criminal conspiracy during his daily commute home. Here's a clip.
What's your problem?
Mike, you gotta let the lady go.
You don't get it, do you? She wants you dead. You witnessed a murder. You have something that she wants. Something she's willing to kill for.
Okay, Mike, you gotta let her go, Mike. Let the lady go. Mike.
Hand me the phone.
Mike. Mike is not letting it go.
No, he won't let that phone go. You can hear it dinging, and he won't let it go there in the background. Yeah, yes, that's Liam Neeson. He's a businessman, former cop, of course, so he does have a particular set of skills that he can use when it comes in handy. You know, I loved one of my favorite Liam Neeson movies the last few years was Nonstop by the same director as this, Jean-Michel Serra. You know, also transportation-based, you know, in the middle of an airliner, in mid-flight, and he's got to find a terrorist murderer on that flight. That was great because it was so simple, so compact. This one, not quite as neat and streamlined. You know, it takes a little more backstory, a little more exposition, some kind of complicated deaths. Not quite as satisfying, but still pretty good. You know, here we are in the middle of January. There's just not that much to see. And this is a great, fun, you know, sort of entertaining, junky action thriller, again, with Liam Neeson.
Yeah, I mean, if you're low on Liam, this will satisfy your craving.
Yes, this will fill your tank.
Your Liam tank. And we all have one. We all know. Rafer, can we take it down just a notch from Liam Neeson and transportation-based thrillers for 1 second.
Okay.
And talk about Paddington Bear.
Yes, Paddington Bear.
Paddington is back in Paddington 2. What did you think?
You know, I was a big fan of the first one, actually, which didn't do that well, but it was actually quite fun, quite smart, had a great villain in Nicole Kidman, but it really didn't get much traction. This is actually a better film, better animation on Paddington himself, the bear. Again, great cast. Hugh Grant as the villain, a master of disguise villain. So much fun. Again, I really hope people see this because I think these movies could really be a great franchise.
I did see the trailer. It looked awfully sweet. Sweet for me isn't usually enough. You're saying it's actually got some...
I think it's also like very, very charming, and it's got a real sincerity that I think kids' films kind of lack these days. And I like that old-fashioned kind of heart to it.
And they've got that British star power back, Hugh Grant as the villain in Paddington 2. All right, Rafer, we couldn't stay away from Liam for very long. I want to go back to trivia. If we can, I played for you some classic Liam Neeson. Let me round out what he had to say there, because you're going to complete this speech for me. If you let my daughter go now, that will be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you. Rafer?
Listen to me very carefully, Todd. That's Taken, right?
Yeah.
Liam Neeson?
Complete it.
Oh, I don't know if I can complete the whole speech.
Your task is to complete the famous speech.
The famous speech.
I will do it again. If you let my daughter go now, that will be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you.
But if you don't, I will look for you. I will find you. And I will kill you.
Taken.
I didn't get it. Sorry, Todd.
Liam Neeson. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. And full Liam all the time. Thanks, Rafer.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today on this Friday. The Trump administration announced Thursday that states can now impose a work requirement on many Americans who rely on Medicaid. This would be the first time in the plan's history that people would have to work to be eligible to keep their Medicaid coverage. Now, advocates say the work requirements help push people out of poverty. Opponents say it's a way to purge Medicaid rolls and take away a safety net that many working and non-working poor rely on. Now, 10 states have requested the work requirements, which include other types of community engagement as well. Mary Harris is managing editor at WNYC's Health Desk. She's in the studio with me now. Hi, Mary.
Hey, Todd.
Well, what exactly does this new policy tell states they can do?
Well, so I'm glad you said it was community engagement. That's how the administration is framing it. They're not saying work requirement.
But except that's what it is.
That's what it is. So what this does is it lets the states be more flexible, and these kinds of waivers have actually been out there for a long time. They helped the Medicaid program, which was established 50 years ago, modernize and experiment and try new things. But this is really the first time we're using these waivers to actually bring the rolls down, because that's functionally what this is doing. When you look at the applications that the states have sent in, they talk about in community engagement, they talk about how work is good for people. But then when they get down to the numbers, what they're really talking about is, for instance, if you look at Kentucky, they're saying in 5 years, we think about 100,000 people will be off our rolls and we're going to save a lot of money with these programs.
So wait a second. I thought, because I was just told by the administration that this was all about lifting people out of poverty, not about getting people off of the safety net.
Well, so that's what they're saying. But I think it's really important to look back at the last time that we did this. The last time we did this was with welfare. And we said the same thing. If you have to work for your welfare money, it's going to lift you out of poverty. And what's interesting is that for the first few years, it looked a little bit like that might be happening. And then when you looked at the longer term impacts, it actually seems like that's not what happened. What happened is that just less and less people got the benefits because it became so onerous to get them. They just kind of gave up.
So who is this supposed to apply to? Who are the Medicaid beneficiaries who would actually be affected by the new policy in these states?
So what they're saying is able-bodied people will be impacted by this. And there's a real question among health policy experts of who are the able-bodied people. About 40% of people on Medicaid don't work. A lot of them are disabled. They're caretakers. Some of them are retired. So the devil is really in the details in terms of who is going to be impacted by this. And this is going to be individual states making decisions and calls about who's able-bodied, who should be working, who shouldn't be working. So we wanted to know how advocates were thinking about this, and we called up Sheila Schuster in Kentucky. And you have to think about Kentucky. It's held out there as a real example of a success story in the ACA because they expanded Medicaid, and that meant that they went from a 20% uninsured rate to an 8% uninsured rate. And she's really proud of that, but she's worried that with these new rules, that's going to just go backwards.
As a psychologist and one who has worked so closely with people with serious mental illness, with substance use disorders, and with developmental and intellectual disabilities, we worry about the burden on those folks who have Medicaid. They're not in the waiver programs, but would not be able to respond to that requirement.
What Sheila Schuster is saying there, that huge swaths of the Medicaid population really aren't people sitting around who don't want to work. They're people who either can't work or only have access to very low-paying employment in the first place.
That's right. And so they also say in this that education could be counted towards your work requirement. And I think that's a really interesting idea because education can help you come out of poverty. But this isn't funding the education. The states would have to fund that themselves. So it creates this tension, right, where we want to lift people out of poverty. We know that education does it. But where's the money going to come from for that? Because we're not going to be able to use Medicaid money to fund that.
Mary, you mentioned the history that we already have with work requirements for welfare programs, for food stamps and things like that. Some states already have programs in place that just basically increase the scrutiny on poor people with Medicaid.
Right. Like, so Seema Verma, who's in charge of CMS, she started a program in Indiana, which is Mike Pence's home state, where the idea was you had to pay for your Medicaid, and it was seen as innovative. But now what you're seeing is that people are filing lawsuits because they're getting kicked off of Medicaid. People are getting dinged for not paying. It turns out it's a bureaucratic error. There's something else going wrong. And I feel like those lawsuits, that's what we're going to see happening with this work requirement. People are going to get kicked off of Medicaid for whatever reason, and then they're going to say, listen, this violates my rights as a disabled person. I need to have access to this care. And that's where we need to be watching next.
Mary, one question at the heart of this is whether Medicaid is in fact a program that is plagued by non-productive people who don't deserve the benefits. I mean, that essentially seems to be the subtext of this policy, right? Which is taxpayers pay for health care for people who could be improving their lives, but just won't do it.
That's right. And for these waivers to go through, they actually have a requirement that it must further the objectives of Medicaid. And until now, we haven't said that a work requirement or anything like it furthers the objectives of Medicaid. And that's important because when you look back at the history, Medicaid and Medicare were founded actually with the idea that they would be expanded, that we would be expanding this coverage to all Americans versus contracting it. And what we're seeing here is that we are contracting it. And I actually think even more toxic than just reducing the roles, which is one thing, is that what we're doing is we're calcifying this idea that there are some people who are moochers in the system, who are taking all of the goodies and, you know, they don't deserve it. And, you know, health policy experts push back on that and they say they don't exist. I'm not sure that they don't exist. I don't know that I would say that, actually. What I'd say instead is that in healthcare, we're all moochers. All of us, no matter where you get your health care, it is funded in some way by the government. I get my health care through my job. That is incentivized by the government. So I'm getting a benefit, but you're not dinging me for being a moocher. And all of us have these stories about times that we have worked the system to get what we need. For me personally, I know that I had cancer, I got a wig, I charged my insurance company $800 for a wig that I wore for 1 hour. Okay, am I a moocher? Should I have been dinged for that? I don't know, but I know that we all do these things, and that's really the point. We're creating an underclass of people who are saying, you are moochers, you are bad, when really everyone does this in the system, and we need to be talking about that.
Mary Harris, managing editor at WNYC's Health Desk. Mary, thanks.
Thanks so much.
The nation's biggest employer had some good news for a lot of its employees yesterday. Walmart announced they'll be doling out bonuses and new benefits to many of the 1.4 million people who work there, and that base wages are also going up to $11 an hour all across the country. And according to the retail giant, it's all thanks to the Republican tax plan that became law just last month. Charles Fishman is author of The Walmart Effect, How the World's Most Powerful Company Really Works. And Charles says it's unlikely that Walmart got the idea for such big changes in just the last few weeks.
It's easy to forget. Walmart is the largest company in the United States and the largest company in the world and the largest company in the history of the world. They have 1.5 million U.S. employees, more U.S. employees than any other company. So you don't change the entry-level wage and you don't roll out something complicated like paid maternity leave to 1.5 million employees without having planned that out and thought about it. So my bet is that the $11 minimum wage and the maternity benefits and the adoption benefit, which is actually quite good, I think those were actually in process. I think getting a tax cut helps.
Well, if it takes a lot of time to sort of steer the ship of Walmart because it's a big ship and you don't make benefit changes overnight, I get it. Still, Walmart appears happy here to position their announcement so that the administration and Republicans in Congress can peg it to tax policy and get the PR benefit. Clearly, they've done that.
Well, they clearly have. Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, said they were accelerating programs that they intended to do anyway in the U.S., and that there was more to come. I do not have access to Walmart's federal tax returns, but by my rough calculation, they will save between $1 billion and $2 billion on their taxes. And the benefits they announced yesterday, they actually put numbers to them. They said the bonuses will cost $400 million, the increased wages will cost $300 million. They didn't put a number on the maternity, paternal leave, and adoption benefits. But at the most generous, this whole package is costing $1 billion or less. And the $400 million, half of that is a one-time payment. So there's going to be extra cash when this is all done for Walmart. To me, the more interesting point is Walmart is voting on behalf of the U.S. economy. These moves are a way of saying, we think the U.S. economy is strong and is going to continue to be strong.
That's interesting. Are they saying that by saying we want to pay higher wages and have better benefits because we want to compete for workers, and if we don't, we won't be able to compete?
Exactly. They're saying we believe unemployment's going to continue to be low. And if we're going to be seen as a desirable place to work, as a reasonable place to work, we have to up our game. Right now, if you work at a place like Walmart, if you're an hourly worker, you're talking about earning $20,000 or $24,000 a year with a full-time job. That's a little basic. If someone offers you a dollar an hour more, if you're making $10.50 and someone offers you $11.50, you cross the street because that puts $40 extra a week in your paycheck. But Walmart has said, we'll pay you for 10 weeks of maternity leave when you have a baby, or we'll put $5,000 on the table, up to $5,000, to help you adopt a child. So The packages announced yesterday are what I think of as kind of sticky benefits. They're a way of helping people say to themselves, I actually want to stay working at this place because there are things I get here that I might not get if I get another dollar an hour.
So if the benefits here, Charles Fishman, for workers at Walmart, and the more than a million of them, are real and will make a difference to their bottom lines, there was also some bad news on the political end and for other workers in the family there, because 63 Sam's Club stores were announced to be closing yesterday at the same time. Maybe not the best political counter message that Walmart wanted on the day it announced these benefits. What's happening there?
I think this was a significant fumble in a couple ways. It's not just 63 Sam's Clubs. It's 10% of all Sam's Clubs in the United States. That's a big repositioning. Walmart is not a company that closes stores. In fact, it's only the second time in the 50-year history of the company that they have announced a quote-unquote mass closing of stores across the nation. The first time was 2 years ago when they closed 260 stores at once, but most of those were neighborhood markets. And so I think this is significant, and I think probably what they saw is that the communities around these Sam's Clubs were going away from shopping at Sam's Club. They were either getting outcompeted by Costco's or people were moving to online, and they didn't see any prospect that these stores were going to come back in the right direction. By the way, closing 63 Sam's Clubs lays off 10,000 Walmart workers. That's a lot of people who lost their jobs yesterday.
Well, Charles Fishman, before we let you go here, let's end with the very bottom line of what Walmart announced yesterday. The total value of new wages and new benefits weighted against the gains that Walmart makes directly from the GOP tax cut. How do they compare? What are workers getting versus what the company got in the tax cut?
Based on what Walmart announced yesterday, the benefit packages they announced will cost them $1 billion or a little less in the first year, and probably $500 million a year going forward after that. They're going to make at least $1 billion in new cash from the tax cut, and maybe considerably more. So they did look around very quickly at their balance sheet after the tax cut and say, we're going to have a lot of money. Maybe we could give some of it to our employees, but they will have a lot of extra cash still left. It'll be interesting to see what they do with it.
Charles Fishman, author of The Walmart Effect. Charles, always great to have you.
Thanks so much, Todd.
Do you or someone you know have experience working for Walmart?
Ernest, calling from the Bronx, New York. My son was formerly employed by Walmart, but left after 2 years for Amazon, which offered better pay, employee benefits, and overall better employee management relations. He has been there 1.5 years now with no regret.
Well, that's Ernest from New York calling about his son. Walmart has sweetened the deal for the more than 1 million workers who are left behind after some workers, like Ernest's son, went to Amazon. Would higher pay at Walmart affect you or someone you know? What about the closures? Call us, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. And that story is coming up here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
And LegalZoom.com, providing public radio listeners with legal advice and guidance on business matters and estate plans through its network of independent attorneys. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
I want to leave you with a thought on what President Trump had to say on Thursday in the White House about people from places like Haiti and El Salvador and places like Africa. The president's words were vulgar and a warning for anyone with young kids with them. You're about to hear the president's vulgar words. The president was talking about immigration in a room full of Democratic and Republican lawmakers. Haiti and El Salvador and Africa came up, and the president asked, "Why do we want all these people from shithole countries coming here?" There are a dozen ways to parse the affront that these words represent to decent Americans. I'll stick to one. The president says he wants merit-based immigration, immigration not based on lotteries or relatives, but on who contributes the most. He tweeted about it again this morning. But compare yesterday's remarks to what the president had to say before about people from Haiti. At a June immigration meeting, he said they all have AIDS. Or about people from Nigeria. At that same meeting, he said they live in huts. Never mind that Nigerian immigrants have higher educational attainment on average than Americans who already live here. The president says he wants merit, and I believe him. He's just made it clear that the entire continent of Africa and Haiti and El Salvador, places filled with black and brown people, don't have merit. They're worth less. Now, I'm not the first to say it, but I want to make sure I do. What the president said is racist. Many of his actions and statements leading up to this moment have been racist, and it's a disgrace. We want to hear your reactions. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always reach us on Twitter, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.